Welcome to Advisor Go Radio. I'm Stephanie Sammons.
And I'm Zach Miller.
Okay, well, we are so excited to announce that we have a new sponsor for the Advisor Go Radio podcast. Isn't that great, Zach?
That's good news.
So we're going to be giving them a plug here in the beginning of every show that they sponsor. And so today's podcast is sponsored by Arcovi Social Media Archiving. Arcovi helps financial professionals and firms leverage the power of social media. And you can learn more from arcovi.com, and that's ARKOVI.com. They've also gone so far as to offer a discount to our listeners of a 20% annual discount off of their services, or a 10% monthly discount if you sign up for monthly. And it's AD, you need to use the sign up code ADVGO11. ADVGO11. So I thought that was pretty cool that they're going to extend a discount on their compliance, social media compliance archiving solution for financial advisors.
Much appreciated. And the whole archival thing is going to be, is and is going to be a big deal, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. You know, you really should not be participating and engaging in social media without it. It's way too much of a risk to not be archiving and recording what you're doing. And I would venture to say that most every financial services firm is going to require it.
Great.
For their advisors. So thanks to Arcovi. So this week, some very interesting news came out. It was actually a study performed by the Spectrum Group. And I had heard of the Spectrum Group. Had you ever heard of them, Zach?
Yeah,
are you familiar?
Yeah, they do a lot of study on the asset management field in general.
Yeah, they do. And they've launched a new web property. It's called MillionaireCorner.com. And it really looks like it's designed for investors. They're trying to provide insight to wealthy investors. And they've even got a tab up there entitled Find an Advisor, which they haven't launched anything on Find an Advisor, but it would be interesting to see how they're going to try to connect wealthy, or millionaires, I guess, the affluent with financial advisors. I know we've seen many attempts before of this nature, and they really
don't
work.
None ended well.
Exactly. Yeah. They really haven't worked. So I'd be interested to see that. But regardless of that, they've got some excellent content. It's very fascinating, and they're doing a lot in the social media area with regard to researching how affluent investors are using social media, if they're using social media or not. So this press release came out, and the title of it was Millionaires' Use of Facebook Has Nearly Doubled Since Last Year. And there were some very encouraging stats here. We'll put this in the show notes. We'll put a link to this press release. But just to highlight a couple of the notes in here, the percentage of U.S. millionaires using Facebook in 2011 has nearly doubled to 46% from 26% from a year ago. And millionaires are defined, this is how they're defining the affluent, as having a net worth of $1 million to $5 million, not including their primary residence. And then similarly, 47% of ultra high net worth investors, those with a net worth of $5 to $25 million, and 55% of the mass affluent who have a net worth of $100,000 to $1 million are also using Facebook. That is incredibly powerful.
Now, they're not necessarily using Facebook to research advisors or the stock market, right? I mean, they're just, it means they're on there, they're participating.
Exactly. No, I don't think that's what they're saying. But that just that they're on there. And what's interesting, there are some other things in here I'd like to point out. But what's interesting about Facebook is I think it's the most ignored channel by financial advisors at this time, especially on the business side. And I think it's the most fascinating untapped opportunity that there is, because there are 750 million users on the network, and over 50% of them log in every day to the site. So I don't, I think you've got to be there. You've got to build a business presence on Facebook. No doubt about it now, especially with this kind of evidence. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm torn. Like, I started out beginning to invest in building a presence there. And then I'm like, well, it's a closed community. You know, what if, obviously Facebook's here to stay for now, but like, what if the community shifts? What if, you know, and whatever I do in there is invisible to people outside the Facebook community because of that walled garden. And I don't know, like, I definitely believe, like, sort of the web tenets are push for openness and more transparency, something we'll talk about later in this episode. But I don't know. I'm torn, and I sort of pull back from really investing in Facebook in spite of the fact that I know everybody's there.
Well, I don't know. I've had a different experience. I feel like with all of the social plugins that Facebook offers, so you can integrate Facebook into your blog. You can integrate Facebook into everything that you publish really online, that, you know, the challenge is getting that visibility in people's news feeds, okay? And the more pages, that business pages and brands that people like and become fans of, and the more friends they have, the more challenging it is to get visibility there. So, mm-hmm. you know, you can set up a Facebook page and you can post something every day and never show up in your fans' news feeds. The best way to show up is to get your fans to engage and comment and share your content. But that's been the biggest challenge, is sort of sure. some of these pages are just ghost towns because no one is engaging with their content. And so I've heard rumors that Facebook is working on tweaking that algorithm so that brands and companies and even financial services groups or teams, anybody who has a business page with fans has a better opportunity to show up in the newsfeed. And right now, literally, it's less than a 5% chance that you're going to show up.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that low.
It's very low. So that's the problem. I mean, Wired Advisors page has over 900 fans and very, very little engagement. And, you know, we post to that page very frequently. But I think that's the problem, is the algorithm is such that, you know, nobody's getting anywhere. And brands are screaming about that to Facebook. You know, they want an opportunity to show up if they're going to spend time and invest in the channel. So it's not perfect.
I definitely, I'd love to be proven wrong. I just, I do post to Facebook. I've hooked up a thing called ping.fm. So that anytime I post to my blog or even to Twitter, I can repost automatically some of that same content to my Facebook page. So, and I get probably somewhere between 3 to 5% of my traffic from Facebook. But I definitely haven't invested yet.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, do you know who Mark Suster is? I think I'm saying sure. his last name correct.
Yeah, the venture capitalist.
Yeah, he's a venture capitalist. His blog is bothsidesofthetable.com. He recently, I saw him tweet that he had a post completely go viral on Facebook, and he got tons of traffic to his blog from that and had no idea how that happened. So I think that sort of speaks to this concept that Facebook really has infiltrated the web. And so there are opportunities, but it's just figuring out, okay, how do you really get visible in there, and how do you go viral? If someone sees your blog post on Facebook and they like it and they share it with their friends, then it's word of mouth amplified. You know, you sure. just, if they've got 500 friends and one of those friends sees it and they've got 500 friends, I mean, it can really multiply quickly your visibility. And I think the best opportunity is the friends of friends, you know, getting mm-hmm. to that second degree connection of your existing relationships and connections is a pretty powerful opportunity.
Yeah, I'd love to have a whole episode on that in the future.
All right, we'll do it. But anyway, that was the crux of this study. And also, what I really liked is that blogs rank as another good way to reach the wealthiest Americans, according to this Spectrum Group study. Nearly one third of the ultra high net worth investors say they either read or would read blogs by trusted financial advisors. And the percentage is interestingly a little bit lower for millionaires and the mass affluent. But I love that because, as you know, blogs are educational marketing through blogging is my big thing. I think it should serve as the central hub of your social media presence.
I think part of the wording in that statistic is interesting, trusted. And I think part of the challenge for advisors is as they build a web presence is to gain that trust.
Because
obviously, once you have that trust, people are willing to listen to you. But what if you put content out and you haven't created that that trust factor yet? So
right.
We're going to need more and more tools and advice and guidance to be able to build that type of presence. Because it's not just put up a blog and write a few articles. That's not enough.
Absolutely, it's building credibility and. Becoming a niche authority, and we can do a session on this as well, because I think if you're not focused on a niche, and we've talked about this before, it's really tough to get that credibility. If you're a generalist, you just can't, I should say, maybe not so much credibility, but traction. It's really hard to get traction if you're not developing a niche for yourself, especially when it comes to blogging. It's so important. You can't just be targeting anybody with money.
You know, it
just doesn't work.
There was another study, and I think I had mentioned it on my blog. I'll get you the link that Dow Jones had done. They even did a conference call around it, I think, in June. They came out with some of the same findings that the wealthy are turning more and more to social media and to the web to get information. And on top of that, we know that the mass affluent and the affluent don't centralize all their assets with one advisor typically. So they're continuing to manage part of that process, and they're going to the web to be able to do that.
I'd love to have that link, and we'll put it in the show notes, because I absolutely think part of this, the evolution of being a financial advisor in a wired world, is accepting the fact that it's going to be increasingly difficult to get all the money from your clients to manage
all the
assets. Yeah,
I totally agree with that. Especially as you're saying, if you're guiding people to be more niche oriented, and that says you're basically admitting to the world, I'm not a generalist. I'm focused on this.
Yes,
which means you're not necessarily going to get the assets that are outside of that set.
Right. It's going to be based around your areas of expertise, and you can't be an expert at everything. Yeah, I think those days are over when you can, I know at Merrill Lynch, we were taught you want to gather all the assets and really deeply penetrate every relationship with products and services. And
they call that share of wallet, right?
Yeah, and it works. It did work, I should say. It was a great strategy to capture all the assets and to make the clients stick. But I just think there's so much competition, it's so fragmented, that's going to be a huge challenge in the future.
So interesting. Yeah, we'll definitely keep our eyes on that trend.
And then I'll also mention, last but not least in this article, that LinkedIn was mentioned as popular among wealthy investors. The percentages there are 19% of millionaires, 26% of the ultra high net worth investors, and 22% of the mass affluent are using the service. Many of them for professional networking. So I think LinkedIn is still, obviously very important. That's where most financial advisors are right now. And then Twitter was the smallest of all the networks. Twitter was, barely a blip here. So I look at Twitter more as, again, a networking tool to network with professionals. And the early adopters there are lots of doctors and lawyers and business owners and professionals and anybody who has to go out and develop customers and clients, they are starting to really embrace Twitter. So I don't know that you're going to find retirees on there.
Right. They don't even quite get what it is because there's no website, right? Really. Yeah.
Exactly. So there are younger folks on Twitter, but also lots and lots of professionals are starting to jump on Twitter. And I also think there are other benefits to Twitter, such as, I know this is not going on currently, but I think it will start happening again. But tweets get indexed by search. Mm-hmm. So your tweets can show up in interesting ways that you might not have thought about if one of your clients is conducting a search and he or she is connected to you socially through Facebook, Twitter, and some of the other channels, you may very well show up when they're searching for something that's financially related for a tweet that you posted. And this was when Google had an agreement with Twitter to index and showcase tweets. Now I think that's been severed momentarily, but I do expect that all of this social sharing will continue to be integrated into online search and make online search much more relevant than it is random based on who you're connected to.
Totally agree with that. And personally, I spend a lot more time working with Twitter in terms of networking, professional networking, as you describe, and learning. I think it's a great way to get exactly the type of content that you're trying to get in a research process. You're just able to, you basically, the way someone described it to me, it's like you open a door and you enter a party that was already happening that you were invited to, right? So you step right in and there's just this very vibrant conversation going on. And I've made friends out of just some of my Twitter contacts I've visited in my travels around the world, and we're going to do business in the future. So I like Twitter a lot. It's not that marketing platform that you're going to reach new clients with.
Yeah. Unless it's very technology or online marketing oriented. I know some of the big online marketers, they really rely on Twitter, but they have 50,000 followers or something right. Crazy like that. So it's difficult to amass that kind of following now because Twitter's changed all the rules. It always seems like the early adopters, the early bird gets the worm. But it's interesting. We use Twitter for our advisors. We built a Twitter list of all the top financial news resources out there. And so literally, you can just log in and check the list and have a streaming flow of current news items instead of having to go to 50 different websites, news websites. Boom, you've got it right there, and you can see the scroll through the headlines and click through to read any article that grabs your attention. But I think Twitter's a great resource for keeping up with, breaking news and relevant news and that kind of thing mm-hmm. for advisors.
And just like I do with Facebook, whenever I publish a new blog piece, I distribute it out onto Twitter as well. And I probably also get about 5-10% of my traffic from Twitter's.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree. It's all these social sites, at least the big ones, are driving traffic to blogs and websites, no doubt about it. Blogs more so in particular. So let's shift gears for a second. I really wanted to speak about some of these, I'm going to call them revolutionary platforms that some of them have been around for a while and some of them are newer, but Zach, you've had experience at a couple of these online platforms that I think are becoming more and more so a resource for financial advisors. And there are positives and negatives to these platforms, but what do you think about talking to us a little bit about your experience and your thoughts on two of them in particular? One is SeekingAlpha.com, and I'll let you talk about kind of what it is and what it consists of, and then Covestor.com, and then there's another one as well that we can hit on, but let's start with Seeking Alpha, since you served in a very prominent role there for a few years, and tell us about the site, tell us about your experience and what you think it holds for financial professionals.
Sure. So just, as an aside, my career, and it's definitely still a work in progress, has been about helping investment businesses grow. And it's typically these types of businesses on the edge, I would say. So I had been a buy-side analyst for a hedge fund and had left to explore some of my own entrepreneurial leanings and was approached by the investor in Seeking Alpha and said, you know, listen, it's all new media, which I had been investing in as a primary principal investor as well. And it's investing, and, you know, you really understand the space. Like, you know, we've got this cool company getting off the ground. Why don't you, you know, they're looking for a biz dev person. Why don't you take over it? And so I hadn't really had that role previously. So Seeking Alpha, its roots were just in really a blog. I was reading Seeking Alpha as an investor. It was David Jackson's, the founder's blog, and he had been an analyst at Morgan Stanley, and he was just writing about tech stocks and providing some commentary on the industry. And in around 2007, I think he sort of hit upon the idea that, you know, maybe this whole blogging thing was going to be big. And the way he could scale was not necessarily writing. You know, and one of the early ideas was going out to Wall Street and hiring away sort of industry analysts and having them write about, you know, their sectors in a blog format. That's not really scalable because, you know, the cost basis there is really insane. What if we could just get other people, other bloggers, like-minded bloggers, contributing their content to Seeking Alpha in sort of a win-win relationship? You give us your content, it gets posted on Seeking Alpha, and Seeking Alpha, as it grows, provides you more prominence and hopefully more traffic back to your website. And Seeking Alpha grew and became really a blog aggregator. And they did it in a smart way. There have been other attempts to do this unsuccessfully. What Seeking Alpha did was basically say the content needs to be top-notch, right? Not all the content is going to be, you know, written by a Nobel Prize winner economist, but there needs to be an editorial process on top of the content that makes it really palatable to high-end investors. And our theory was always if we could get the type of content that would be palatable to high-end investors yet jargon-free enough that retail investors would enjoy using it, what a great platform for everybody. Everybody wins. And so when I joined, it was still just you know, in the early stages of evolving from a single person's blog to becoming sort of this what they call long tail type content aggregator, where they were just aggregating. You know, we had one guy who was writing only on eBay, just the one stock, and he did incredible research that nobody even on the sell side could do, just because he had the time and the energy to focus on one stock. And my job was basically to go out to mainstream media and do distribution deals. And we got them all done. We got a deal with Yahoo Finance so that, you know, when a contributor writing about eBay, you know, submits their content to Seeking Alpha, that content in turn gets syndicated out to not only Yahoo Finance, but pretty much all the mainstream financial portals that you can think of. And, you know, that was really, you know, at that time we talked about sort of the Wild West of the blogosphere. You know, you couldn't really tell who was writing or who was trustworthy, an issue that we've talked about already in this podcast. Mm-hmm. And Seeking Alpha's job was to provide that credibility layer on top, to provide the tools for readers to be able to discern who's smart, who's not smart, and to provide more than anything. And I think the differentiator with Seeking Alpha and blogging in general versus what you can get in mainstream media is that we introduced opinion into, like, sort of the media fest, where, you know, journalists for MarketWatch or Dow Jones in general are not typically allowed to own stocks. They don't have experience trading some of the securities that they're writing about. We said, well, it'd be great if we can actually get advisors or professionals to write about these same things that they're investing in. And, you know, what a great way to learn from experts. And Seeking Alpha has become one of the largest financial web properties around. And they've grown as a company. They've grown in prominence. And, you know, it is a go-to resource now for a lot of investors.
Yeah, you know, they've got, just looking here, close to 800,000 members. And I remember back when they were at a couple hundred thousand. So they've really grown substantially.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do we have any idea how many practicing financial professionals are on the platform?
As writers?
Yeah, as that contribute content to the platform.
Right, so I don't have that number offhand. You can do a search. I think in the bottom left-hand corner of the website, you can do a search.
Yeah,
by...
I remember seeing it, but I don't see it anymore. Oh, here. I don't see it anymore. We'll try to find that out. I'm just curious.
So, but just to walk through the process, what happens is pretty much anybody can submit an article to become a Seeking Alpha contributor. you basically give them your content. They host your content for you. And you're allowed to build a profile of who you are and put some links to your blog, your tell a little bit about your company. If you have a book, you can link off to the book. But essentially, the content is hosted and resides on Seeking Alpha. And in turn, they syndicate it out to their other media partners. So, you know, that one piece of content that you write can really make its way, you know, throughout the media run.
And how, you know, what do you think the I'm assuming that's a pretty low percentage that they've, you know, I know they're also paying some of their contributors now, but my guess would be there's so much content there that they're only going to be a small sliver of contributors who are getting that kind of visibility.
Right, like in any marketplace, right, it's, I don't know if it's 80-20 or 90-10 or something like that, but yeah, there'll be a very small group of people that get a lot and pretty much everyone else gets very little. I no longer contribute content to Seeking Alpha for a variety of reasons. I think the company is great. I still use it to do research. They've even moved into a new realm, and we'll save this for another time, but they're developing third-party investing tools, software-type platforms that plug in, just like you have an app store on your iPhone or whatever. Seeking Alpha is creating an investing app store. That'll be interesting to see how that sort of pans out. But it is an easy way for an advisor who wants to syndicate their content out to a broad audience, you know, to get up and running. And if you're good, you can opt into a payment program where I've heard some, I think they quoted, they've already paid out over $1 million this year to contributors. But that program requires you to, Seeking Alpha owns that content in its entirety. You cannot repost that anywhere. That's their content. So essentially they're buying the content from you. You get a rev share on page views.
A thousand page views, I think, right?
Yeah, $10 for 1,000 page views. And, you know, I've heard one contributor, seeing like something like a few thousand bucks a month from the program, almost up to 10,000, I think.
Okay.
That's another model. I mean, so, you know, Seeking Alpha is in a tenuous position. They want people to submit content to them for free. And in return, they're trying to provide non-monetary benefits, which are eyeballs, readers. But you have to understand that if you do contribute to Seeking Alpha, you're not going to get all the traffic back. They're not, Seeking Alpha is meant to be a destination site. They're not in the business of siphoning off traffic.
Right.
If a reader is interested in drilling down and understanding more about the person that wrote the article, it's definitely there for them to take to avail themselves of. But most of the traffic resides within the Seeking Alpha website.
Yeah, you know, and I'll also say, because I experimented with it early on as well, actually several years ago before I ever launched Wired Advisor. And what I found was that my content that I contributed to Seeking Alpha took over my search results for my name. And it took a long time to push that down and get my own blog and my own properties up toward the top of, you know, page one of my Google search results for my name. And as we know, you know, people do a lot of research on people through search engines. So, you know, the first thing somebody does is Google your name to find out more about you. And what was happening was they'd click straight through to Seeking Alpha and then completely I'd lose them because it's got so much content. You know, they're going to stick around and on Seeking Alpha and look around and read everything there. So they'd never come visit my site. So that's, I think, the downside is when you contribute content to other places, it's a great way to get some visibility, but at what price is what you have to weigh.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, one of the sites that I contribute to now as a regular contributor is socialmediaexaminer.com, and it's probably the leading online magazine for social media for business. And I made the conscious decision to do that because it's certainly the kind of visibility and traffic that site draws. I mean, they've got 100,000 email subscribers. And so that they only publish one article per day, though. So on the day that my article publishes, I get lots and lots of visibility for that. And so I calculated that was a worthwhile endeavor for me to sacrifice my brand and my content, and it's not a sacrifice because there's upside in it. But you just have to be very careful about where you're going to put your content, because that's where you might get visibility, and it may or may not work out for you. So I don't know.
That's a great point, because a lot of these activities are competitive against one another. So one strategy is to use Seeking Alpha for a subset of your content that you're just using to build some visibility, and continuing to build your own web presence with your blog and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's sort of, I think, you know, how a lot of advisors are approaching it. But what I would caution anybody from jumping whole hog into giving all their content all the time to Seeking Alpha, because you're competing against the Seeking Alpha brand as well. And, you know, you'll be better off developing your own content, getting your own search engine, you know, optimization going on, right, on your own site versus, Seeking Alpha. But again, you're going to start building something on your own. It takes time, takes energy, you know, to get that traction that we're talking about. Seeking Alpha sort of gives you that, you know, sort of a condensed, you know, accelerated version of getting eyeballs. And that's a rush in the beginning. So definitely caution you to, you know, to diversify your efforts.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we always preach, own your content, you know, make your home base, your blog, own that content, and then figure out where you want to distribute it. And it's a channel like everything else, you know, even social media, social networks are channels that you don't own. So you want to own your home base and your library of content, but then you can decide, you know, where you want to put some of that online.
So this is, and I know we're nearing the end of this episode, but this is a good segue into one of the other platforms we want to talk about. And just to do it quickly, is it's Covestor, and it kind of dovetails well with the Seeking Alpha story. So whenever I pitch Seeking Alpha to contributors or to potential media partners, I always say, well, why are people writing their content and giving away for free? Why are people doing this? And we said, well, most of the guys are advisors. They're in the business of giving away content because hopefully that, you know, that generates leads, which they convert into paying clients. And the problem was on the blogosphere, it wasn't quite clear what that loop looked like. And, you know, Seeking Alpha gave you a broad distribution mechanism, but it wasn't quite clear that was actually going to provide you as an advisor, a contributor, any income. So few years back, we started hearing about the development of a company called Covestor. And Covestor basically was a marketplace of portfolios. Anybody could put a portfolio up and begin sharing their ideas. It was kind of social stock investing. There were a lot of these sites around the time. The difference with Covestor was that they actually plugged into your trading account. So people that were saying that, you know, they had these X type of returns, it was actually audited. And both Covestor and their partner, which was Kaching, now known as Wealthfront, about 2 years ago, got registered with SEC, so that portfolio managers could actually turn their portfolios inside out and through the Covestor platform begin bringing on assets. And, you know, there's a certain level of transparency. All the stuff gets pushed through. A lot of advisors are not necessarily comfortable with that, but I think that's where everything's headed. I think, Steph, you see it the same way. But Covestor is another platform if you're a model manager, of being able to push out your portfolio to a wider audience to get access to assets that you wouldn't necessarily reach before.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating concept. And
you had a portfolio up there, didn't you?
I did. I had an ETF portfolio out there very early on, and I was the only female on the platform. But, you know, my challenge was, and I think they've changed this now, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my challenge was I had a balanced portfolio and I was not going to rank well at the top of the list of performers. You know, the number one performer had all of his assets in a couple of penny stocks at the time and, you know, had 50% returns. And so I thought just ranking by performance was a loser's game ultimately. And then I could never really get visibility because my returns were not going to be up there. But now they're also evaluating by risk, aren't they? Mm-hmm.
Yes, they hired a chief investment officer, and they're trying to bubble up, I guess, non-performance. Well, not they're trying to get away from chasing hot money, right? Because although that happens all the time with individual investors, whether they're mutual funds or ETFs, it can't always be about performance. But unfortunately, some of those guys who are trading beta or whatever, those guys are going to have, you know, huge returns, but they also blow up. And so a balanced portfolio sort of gets lost in the mix. I still agree that that's an issue that we need to address going forward.
Well, it's still, you know, they're taking what they're solving, in my opinion, is the small account problem.
Right.
That a lot of advisors, it's just not efficient to take on the smaller accounts because of all the work involved in managing and maintaining those accounts. And this is sort of a way to outsource. You choose the asset level, but it's a way to for your investors to follow you and be able to mirror your trades and your portfolios, but you're outsourcing all the work and you're still getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you mentioned, you know, transparency. So every trade that you do is completely visible. And I know that's an issue. A lot of advisors are really not comfortable with being completely transparent about every trade that they do. When they do it in real time, I should say, because you've got to disclose, right, what you're doing in an account with a client. But with regard to this being a discretionary model, but every trade is visible in real time, mm-hmm. essentially. So, but I do think we're moving in that direction. I don't think that your differentiator in the marketplace is your investment strategy, and it's the relationships that you build. So, and it's not, you just can't compete on price and performance and all those things that we've learned over time. You've got to compete in different areas now, and we can talk about that in a new segment. But anyway, what do you think?
You got my juices flowing. I could talk all day about this stuff.
Okay. Yeah. I think you've got to get a lot more creative about how you differentiate yourself in this wired world because, listen, transparency is here. Privacy is gone, whether you like it or not. That's,
I mean,
the client, world
clients are
in.
Pushing for this stuff. It really comes from the client point
yeah,
of view.
Yeah,
they're
really
leading
does.
this transparency evolution.
Well, cool, Zach. Well, thanks for going through those different platforms with us. And there are more that I'd like to talk about in
sure.
the future. But
and we'll put links to all these stuff up on the blog.
Yeah, absolutely, we will. And so that's going to wrap up today's session of AdvisorGo Radio. I'm Stephanie Sammons.
And I'm Zach Miller.
And we'll see ya.
Thanks for joining us.